Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations stance point. With your host, Dan Rennie.
Welcome to Let's Talk. Before I begin, I'd like to stop to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land where we broadcast from here in the West End of Brisbane. Also, I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and to all the TOs right across the country where our program goes out to. It's great to have your company. Well, today we shine a light on the systematic racism that is rife within the Queensland Police Service. Pretty hard to ignore when a decorated officer, Richard Monet, a proud First Nations man, walked away after 26 years. Now the latest recorded audio from the Watch House. Disgusting to hear on the streets, let alone in a police organisation. And that is just the tip of the iceberg. Tomorrow, we'll have a yarn to Richard. He'll be detailing just how rampant and deep this goes. It's safe to say it isn't an isolated incident. Joining me today is Brisbane City Councillor Jonathan Shree. Hey, Jonah.
So, how's it going?
Good to see you, brother, as always.
Thanks. I'd like to also acknowledge rightful owners of country and pay respects to the Yuggera and Turrbal peoples and shout out to all the elders.
Now, as we do, we always ask where you're from, who's your mob. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my father's from Sri Lanka. He's a Tamil man, and Sri Lanka has its own history of invasion and colonisation by the British. And mum's a white Australian who grew up in Nambour. So I was born and raised here in so-called Brisbane, and I've been the city councillor for the Gabba Ward, which is on Brisbane's inner south side around West End, Woolloongabba, Kangaroo Point. I've been councillor for about 6.5 years now.
You're a unique fella, Jonah.
Thanks.
In the best possible way. I don't think I've ever seen or met a politician quite like you.
And, I appreciate that.
I think you've stated before that you're an accidental politician.
Yeah, definitely didn't plan to become a politician, but the rents started rising and we had to get active.
Yeah. You've had your fair share of dealings with the Queensland Police Service. We only have to look back some 20, 30 years to, the Fitzgerald era, and, of course, under Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen, where corruption and racism was rife at the time. And, allegedly still is.
Yeah, and my partner Anna Carlson writes a bit about this, but the Fitzgerald inquiry is often described as this, like, pivotal moment in Queensland history where they rooted out all the corruption and they got rid of all the bad eggs, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, in many respects, the Fitzgerald inquiry was a bit of a fig leaf. They made some minor reforms. They actually gave the police more funding, and then that sort of acted like this signifier to say, oh, we've broken from the bad past. Don't worry, the Queensland Police is a new organisation now. But actually, a lot of the same people were still working there. The same organisational values were still entrenched, and the same racist foundations of the Queensland Police remained intact. So, yeah, I don't think racism in the Queensland Police Service ever went away. It was just sort of they put more resources into being more covert and sophisticated about it. So maybe sometimes they're less overt and obvious, but they're still targeting people of colour. They're still targeting First Nations people. They're still investigating reports and so-called crimes differently depending on who the complainant is and who the victim and who the alleged perpetrator is. So, yeah, not much has changed, to be honest.
Is this a bigger story than we're hearing about right now? I mean, they say a fish rots from the head. Is this, all the way to the top?
Yeah, and I think in a way, like, I wouldn't say this in a shorthand interview because it's a bit of a more complex idea, but it's definitely, the leadership is definitely implicated in this, and certainly people at the top need to be taking more responsibility and should be held to account. But it's actually the systems themselves and the structure and the nature of policing in the colonial nation state itself that's the problem. So it's not just that, oh, the leadership are looking the other way or are covertly encouraging this sort of stuff. And it's not just that the people at the bottom might be coming in with racist views or learning bigotry from their workmates or whatever. It's that the nature of policing is an inherently violent and colonial process because you're subjugating particularly First Nations peoples, but anyone who's standing up against the status quo or refusing to comply with society's dominant norms. And so in that context, it's not really about individuals. It's not about individual leaders or the police commissioner as an individual. It's about this kind of ongoing unresolved tension where you're using the police to enforce unjust social relationships. You're using the police to perpetuate a system of inequality and structural abuse. So, of course, the police are going to have problems with racism and sexism and violence because they're trying to uphold an unjust society.
Not all cops are bad. We've seen, particularly down here in West End, in the last 5 years or so, police officers like Sandy Trembath, Senior Sergeant Jeff Douglas, who's come in with a fresh take on policing. And it's the approach, I think, that particularly Sandy uses, where it's not the old, who are you, where are you going, what are you doing? It's more of, how are you? You know, are you okay? Do you need any help? Why can't police be more that way? Why does it have to be confrontational?
Look, I mean, maybe you have to ask the cops this. I think it's sometimes easier to do that style of community policing because you're not necessarily called upon to enforce the most unjust power relationships. So, the quote-unquote friendly neighbourhood cop who might get to know everyone on the street and talk to the local community groups and stuff, they might not be the person who's called in to deal with a more complex issue of substance abuse or domestic violence or whatever. So they're not necessarily doing the pointy end of policing work necessarily. And sometimes when you do meet those quote-unquote good cops or the ones who are trying to, you know, build community relationships, what they're really doing is more like the role of a social worker or even in some cases, a community development worker. They're not actually really doing what their job description tells them to do.
Right.
And they're often violating or ignoring certain policies in order to build those relationships with the community and in order to try to help people in small ways on the ground. So some of those officers you mentioned, like, I don't want to speak for them, but in some ways they're probably violating protocol because they're, you know, building friendly relationships and sometimes they're making, so for example, right, we still have these laws against being drunk in public, which I think are very racist. They're almost entirely used to criminalize First Nations people and vulnerable people. You don't ever see the police patrolling at the picnic grounds in New Farm Park to pick up upper middle class white people who are getting a bit sloshed at their over their champers. But if, you know, police officers, if they see someone who they suspect is drunk in public, kind of their job description requires them to use force to, find that person or lock them up or whatever. So sometimes police officers will make a choice not to do that. And those are often the police officers where, like, oh, look, that person's good because they're not hassling people as much. But they're actually breaking their organization's own rules to do that. So this is the funny thing about large organizations. They have a certain organizational culture, and the culture shapes the systems and the processes and the policies. But in turn, those systems and processes and policies shape and dictate the culture, and those two things are kind of in a symbiotic relationship, informing each other and perpetuating each other. And right now we definitely have a rotten culture of racism and abuse within the Queensland Police, and that, I would argue, is partly being reinforced by the way the rules are written, by the policies that the officers are meant to follow. They come into the role and they're told, this is how you do your job, this is what your job description requires of you. And then they learn those kinds of values as a result of the rules they're following.
Jonathan Shree, Councillor for the Gabba Ward, is our guest this morning on Let's Talk. We're shining a light on the systematic racism within the Queensland Police Service. John, I spoke to Richard last night in length on the phone. We're going to be catching up tomorrow on Let's Talk. And, you know, I spoke to him about the PLOs and the lack of PLOs in the community, those community engagement type roles. He stated that it's so difficult for, you know, a PLO to leave the city, come across the bridge to West End. So it's basically that, you know, that White Australia policy all over again.
Wow.
And it's you know, of course, Moorba have a long and fruitful distrust of the police to begin with. So to be, you know, told you can't go across the bridge there, and if you do, you have to answer to to such and such and make sure you're back before dark. Yeah, interesting to hear that from Richard.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm so inspired by his bravery in speaking out, right? Like that would have been a really hard call for him to come out publicly, and I think it's really important that more people with his insight do that, and similarly the whistleblower who's been speaking about Roma Street Watch House. But just on the PLO program, I don't pretend to have a deep or long knowledge about this stuff, but my understanding is that it started out with like Aboriginal community orgs, particularly, you know, groups connected to Murray Watch and that sort of thing, saying, we'll run this PLO service. We'll have our own people that we are connected to and who are accountable to community, and they're going to keep an eye on the police and they're going to move around with them and be that contact point or bridge point between the police and community on the ground. But what then happened was that PLO, which was a community-led initiative, was sort of co-opted, and then the police gave them sort of police-looking uniforms, and they're employed by the police, and they're accountable to, you know, the senior leadership within the police. So they've kind of been brought into the police organisation rather than sitting independently from it. So they were meant to be there as kind of a separate, autonomous, community-controlled initiative that helps deal with some of these issues in the police, but instead now they're just another arm of the police. And that's it's kind of a subtle shift, but it's a big one because it undermines the ability of PLOs to do the work that they actually think is necessary.
The latest audio that was released from the Brisbane Watch House, made me sick to my stomach to hear those
shocking
those
stuff,
words.
Hey?
These three grubs sitting around, throwing around the language that they did. I probably couldn't have listened to the whole thing had I not had to do it for work, but... What did you make of that audio?
Yeah, and I guess I should warn listeners that like it was pretty racist and confronting stuff, and I don't want to repeat it all, but like there was a lot of really heavy, like, you know, stuff that I'd describe it to some journalists as being the sort of stuff you'd hear at a Ku Klux Klan meeting, like
100%.
Really overtly racist, like talking about exterminating people, talking about beating up and burying black people. One of the phrases when they were talking about a supposed overpopulation in Africa, they're like, oh, I hope Ebola works. Like, it was really genocidal stuff. Mm. A lot of really Islamophobic commentary. Like, the way they were talking about Muslim people was like treating them like absolute scum. It was really awful stuff. And, of course, a lot of really inappropriate commentary about First Nations people, overtly racist terminology that, like, words that even school kids know not to use, and these guys are using it openly. And I think probably the most shocking one for me was where they were joking about kind of forcing an Aboriginal woman who was being held into custody into giving one of them a blowjob. Mm. Like, that alone should be national headline news. If women who are being held at the Watch House have been even indirectly pressured or like sexually harassed in any way, like, that is a scandal all by itself. But it's just one example in a long, long list of really shocking commentary that's been recorded. And it I guess, like, the other important point here is that this is the stuff that they're saying just while they're sitting at the front desk of the Watch House, just like casually chatting a couple of coppers, a couple of Watch House officers. They're not even doing this like in a private secret conversation somewhere where they think no one's going to hear. They're doing this like in the middle of the big space where people are coming and going without even feeling embarrassed or feeling like they have to hide what they're saying. And so if they feel like they can say this kind of overtly racist stuff in a fairly kind of public space in a way, what are they saying when no one else is listening?
Mm. Who are they accountable to?
Well, this is a part of the problem, is that Queensland Police usually just investigates itself. And we've seen so many examples in recent years, examples of police brutality, deaths in custody, allegations of police sexual harassment or abuse. And consistently, the police have their own ethical standards unit, which just goes back and investigates and then says, yes, we've responded appropriately. And there's not even transparency about how the officer was dealt with. And I've experienced this myself, where a few years ago, I was riding my push bike home from an Invasion Day rally, and this copper pulls me up as I'm coming through South Brisbane and pulls me over and issues me a fine for running a yellow light on my bicycle. Like, the stuff that you're like, this is how Queensland Police are spending their time to fine. Like, I was wearing a shirt from the protest. Like, yeah. I think they To
be fair, Braz, you probably do have a target on you.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. Like, in some of the recordings from the Watch House, they definitely talk about me openly, and they it's obvious that a fair chunk of the coppers in Brisbane do have a thing, have something in for me. But this copper, he fined me for running yellow light my push bike, and then later I realised that this same dude had been essentially harassing me on social media for a solid 2 years, like posting abusive and really critical commentary on my public councillor page. He was what I would describe as one of the worst trolls on my page.
A police officer.
He's a serving police officer. And then, you know, we showed this to the police prosecutors and they dropped the fine. Like, they dropped the charge of the yellow light on the push bike. There wasn't even good evidence for it. But I then wrote to the police minister and the commissioner and I said, look, what action has been taken against this officer? He's clearly targeted me and been discriminating against me. And I didn't even get a response. They wouldn't even give me the dignity of a reply. And I'm an elected official. So you think, well, if a serving police officer is trolling and, like, harassing an elected official and then targeting them and misusing his power to issue traffic fines without lawful basis against an elected official, what are they doing to...
What chance have we got?
Yeah, vulnerable Murrays who don't have that kind of privilege.
Yeah. The Human Rights Commissioner, Scott McDougall, has called for an independent commission, calling for scrutiny of police after those recordings. A good step?
Yeah, it is a good step. And I think credit to Scott for, you know, being on the right side of history and stuff. But, I mean, we've had plenty of commissions and inquiries in the past, right? We've had the deaths in custody. Like, they made recommendations, what was it, like 30 years ago?
Yes, yep.
Like, and those were, you know, there was a deep, long-running inquiry that said, look, here's the problem, here's what changes need to happen. And governments just haven't made those changes. So it's one thing to have an inquiry that reveals all this stuff and to have a bunch of recommendations for change. But if there's no political will and the politicians aren't willing to exercise leadership and insist on often what are very straightforward and minor changes, then it sort of makes you think, oh, great, another inquiry. What's this going to change kind of thing? So I don't, like, yeah, we want more scrutiny and transparency. We want definitely want more, a closer look at this stuff. But it also has, we have to be asking that question of the politicians. Are you actually serious about addressing this stuff? Because, you know, at the same time as they're holding this inquiry, the latest inquiry about abuse and sexism and whatnot in the police, they're also announcing that they're going to give the police way more money. So it's like...
And more coppers on the street.
Yeah, all of this
stuff.
And
more detention centres.
Exactly. So yeah. If you're serious about changing the system, why are you just pumping more and more money into doing more of the same? And that's the question for politicians. And that's why I'm like, well, great, it's good to call for another inquiry. But my view is that if you know that there is a significant number of violent racists in an organisation, don't give that organisation guns and the power to arrest people and big salaries. Like, you shouldn't, as the Queensland government, you shouldn't be funding racists. You shouldn't be paying them to patrol the street with weapons and the power to use violence against others. And if the Queensland government can't guarantee that there aren't a heap of Nazis in the Queensland police, then it shouldn't be funding the Queensland police. And I know that's a strong position to take, but we're talking about safety and people's lives here. We're talking about a situation where bigots who are proudly articulating really violent, borderline genocidal ideas in the Watch House are then walking out of that place and potentially kicking heads. And in that kind of context, it's not enough to say, oh, we need some anti-racism training, or we need another inquiry, or we, you know, this is a really big issue. This is sort of foundational.
Speaking of politicians, you're in there. Is there racism within politics?
Yeah, there is. And I think, I mean, often when we talk about racism, we make the mistake of thinking about, like, the overt or casual racism, like people making racist jokes or, you know, making subtle racist commentary. And I see a little bit of that from some of the city councillors. But really, racism and politics manifests as racist policy making. Mm-hmm. And politicians who, you know, whatever their justifications or motivations are, they are making racist comments, they're making racist laws or laws that have racist impacts. And that's how racism manifests within the political class and within parliament. It's when they pass rules that treat people of different nationalities differently. So, for example, you know, Australia's immigration system, it makes it way easier to immigrate to Australia if you're from, like, England or if you're from the US than if you're from other parts of the world. Mm. And similarly, in terms of the way, you know, we've seen overtly racist legislation like the anti-intervention and some of the policing powers in remote Aboriginal communities. So politicians, their racism isn't the really obvious stuff like, you know, using racial slurs or
making... Watch House banter.
Yeah, they're much more sophisticated about it. And their form of racism is about upholding the colonial nation state. And so when politicians pass rules that allow a mining corporation to dig up Aboriginal land in violation of the traditional owners, or when politicians allow property developers to bulldoze a forest at Deeping Creek, that's what racism in politics looks like.
Mm. Very interesting. Always fascinating to have a yarn with you, Jono. Lastly, I'm just curious, were you invited to the vigil for Cassius Turvey?
I wasn't directly invited. I went along and then I ended up offering my PA system and, yes, and running.
I asked you that because the Premier was interviewed about why she wasn't in attendance, and her response was she never received an invite.
Yeah, and that's there were quite a few Greens politicians at the event who also didn't receive an invite. Yeah, yeah. They just rocked up. They knew that it was a big public event and that it was important to show support. And there is a striking contrast where sometimes when perhaps a non-Indigenous person dies in horrific circumstances and the public organises a vigil, the response from premiers and mayors and politicians is like, oh, we'll help organise it. And they'll reach out to the family and they'll say, what do you want? We'll put on an official event for you. In this case, they didn't even give us mains power in King George Square.
Kept the video screen rolling.
Yeah. We're running off battery power and being drowned out by noise from an advertising screen. Whereas, you know, the politicians could have reached out and said, hey, how can we support this event, and been proactive about showing solidarity with the family. And so I don't want to be too critical, like I don't know exactly what the Premier was up to that day, but, you know, make an effort, right?
Is it normal to receive an invite to such an event, or, you know, as a politician, do you...
To be honest, it is pretty common that event organisers will formally reach out and invite people to things, and the difference is kind of between genuine community organised events and events that are organised by bigger NGOs or whatever. So, like, politicians get a lot of events and they're turning down more invitations than they actually accept. And so I can understand why that was the Premier's default reaction of like, well, I get lots of events and invitations and no one invited me to this one.
But that's the response I got from our chief of staff.
Yeah, and I get that, but this is a different kind of thing. This is organised by community. It's clearly a huge groundswell of support. There were thousands of people in the square. You'd think at least her staff would say to the Premier, hey, this looks important, maybe you should make time for this.
I'm not an expert in politics by any means, but the interview from Kate Banfield on Channel 10 News, a quote was, and don't, this isn't word for word, but my office never received an invite, and this is a matter, a WA matter. Just really cold-hearted. I mean, the thing you could have said was, yes, I should have been there. No, I didn't receive an invite. However, I extend my deepest condolences to the Turvey family and all the First Nations people of this country.
Exactly. At least don't be dismissive and defensive about it, you know?
She seems to be quite that way, the Premier. She seems to get on the back foot and sort of arc up when she's cornered or confronted.
And Labor in particular is very complicit in this stuff, and I think is going through a bit of an identity crisis, because historically Labor was often seen as a party of social justice and speaking up for issues like land rights and speaking up against racism. But increasingly now their hands are just as dirty as the other side. And Palaszczuk represents the electorate of Inala, and you have to wonder, like, why are people still voting for someone who is doing nothing about racism and sexism in the police and is locking up kids in watch houses, is putting more and more funding to have more cops on the street and build more prisons to lock up predominantly First Nations people? Why are people still voting for him?
Well, it was good enough for the Prime Minister to come out and, you know, say it was a racially motivated crime. What did you make of Anthony Albanese's comments?
Yeah, I mean, he was right. It was clearly a racist attack, and he was right to call it that. I think, again, what I want to see is action. I want to see, it's often really easy for politicians in positions of power to say all the right things, but these people control budgets. They control where funding goes. They control law and policy. If Albanese is serious about, you know, pushing back against racism, a good place to start would be to decriminalise a lot of the, you know, things like marijuana that they shouldn't be crimes. If anything, those addictions should be dealt with as health issues. But that's leading to a lot of people, a lot of Murrays and people of colour, but a lot of poor white folks as well, getting locked up and then, you know, getting drawn into that prison industrial machine when they don't need to be. So, you know, he's got the power to make some quick changes, and he should be doing that.
Once again, it's an open invitation to the Premier. I know she loves her invitation, so it's an open invitation for the Premier to come on and have a yarn to the First Nations mob here in Queensland on Let's Talk. I think the organisers had other things on their minds, as you said before, arranging PAs, photos, among other things. So thank you as well for the PA on the day. Very little support from elsewhere.
Thanks. Yeah, I guess that's my responsibility, is to support and uplift marginalised voices. So
Jonathan Shree, we always appreciate your time, brother. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for the chat.